This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 2nd, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A bipartisan bill that would increase police surveillance and tracking of citizens has come under criticism from civil libertarians. New Yorkers Against the War protest the Justice Department's unexplained detentions of over 1,000 people since September 11th. And Pacifica board members are in mediation today with plaintiffs of four lawsuits against the network's controversial practices. We'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Reversing earlier objections, the Bush administration says that it will work with the international community to implement the Biological Weapons Convention. Raphael Rothschild has details from Washington.
In a move that takes President Bush even further away from a unilateralist foreign policy, the White House said that it will support strengthening the 1972 Convention banning biological weapons, signed by 144 countries. The administration had previously opposed the enforcement protocols, which allow for spot checks of medical facilities in each country, saying that they would compromise U.S. business interests by exposing American corporations to industrial espionage. But with the recent anthrax infections and fear of other biological or chemical attacks, the White House outlined its support for the accord, and envoys will arrive in Geneva later this month to negotiate the terms for future enforcement of the ban. The new, more inclusive approach to select international agreements has shown that the Bush administration is more willing to ditch its former emphasis on going it alone and stay involved in cooperative efforts to deal with international issues. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Raphael Rothschild.
The International War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague has sentenced five Bosnian Serbs to prison terms, ranging from 5 to 25 years. The men ran the notorious Omarska detention camp at the start of the Bosnian War. Omarska came to be viewed as a symbol of ethnic hatred in Bosnia. From The Hague, Geraldine Coughlin.
During the trial, the five men maintained they were innocent of any crime, but the court found them guilty of crimes against humanity, including murder, persecution, torture, and rape. The judge also convicted them of belonging to a joint criminal enterprise that conducted an intentional policy of discrimination against non-Serbs. He said they took part in a hellish orgy of persecution. Around 6,000 Bosnian Muslims and Croats were held in appalling conditions at the Serb camps. Hundreds died from starvation and beatings. Prosecutors had claimed the camps were used by the Serb authorities as instruments of ethnic cleansing in the drive to create a greater Serbia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin at The Hague.
The passage of an aviation security bill by the House that does not make airport security workers federal employees will face a stiff challenge in conference committee from its Senate counterpart. A bill that federalizes baggage screeners and passed the Senate 100-0. Gareth Schweitzer is on Capitol Hill.
In a vote earlier this week, a Democratic bill in the House of Representatives to federalize airport security failed by 4 votes, as 6 Democrats voted with Republicans against the measure. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt blamed Republicans who deserted at the last minute for the bill's failure.
Why did we have 16 or 17 co-sponsors of the Senate bill on the Republican side and most of them dropped off? Why weren't they able to stand up for what they believed in?
At the Capitol in Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
A ruling in the class action lawsuit brought by more than 600 demonstrators who were arrested during the 1999 World Trade Conference in Seattle says that the establishment of a no-protest zone does not violate the protesters' constitutional rights. Martha Baskin has more on the story from Seattle.
The class action suit against the city of Seattle was given a temporary setback this week when U.S. District Court Judge Barbara Rothstein ruled that the city's creation of a no-protest zone, which barred protesters from a 25-square-block area, was in the interests of public safety and did not violate the constitutional rights of those protesting. According to Steve Berman, an attorney with Trial Lawyers for Public Justice, the ruling was just a single brushstroke in a broader canvas of illegal behavior by the police and the city of Seattle. Such issues included spraying tear gas directly into protesters' eyes, to billy-clubbing protesters already down, and tossing concussion grenades into crowded shopping areas. The lawsuit, Hankin versus the City of Seattle, charges charges at the arrest and imprisonment of the class members, none of whom were later convicted of any crime, deprived them of their rights to free speech and assembly under the First Amendment, their right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment, and the right to speak freely under Article 1, Section 5 of the Washington State Constitution. Berman has not decided whether to appeal the ruling now or wait until the remainder of the plaintiff's claims go to trial. He is confident, however, that the ruling will be overturned. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
B-52 bombers pounded the front line north of Kabul in one of the strongest attacks so far, blasting a Taliban field headquarters. Afghan opposition forces said the bombing appeared directed by U.S. forces on the ground. Strong U.S. attacks were also reported today against Taliban positions defending the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif. The attacks against both the Kabul and Mazar-e-Sharif fronts showed increased U.S. support for the opposition Northern Alliance, which seeks to push through Taliban defenses before winter makes ground offenses more difficult. Overnight, Taliban forces clashed with supporters of an influential Pashtun leader who had slipped back into the country to rally support for a council. Last week, a similar mission to mount opposition to the Taliban among southern Afghan Pashtuns received a severe blow when former guerrilla leader Abdul Haq was captured and hanged near Kabul. Today's attacks came as U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld headed to Moscow for talks on the military effort in Afghanistan, as well as the United States' plans for a missile defense system. Rumsfeld will then head to the Central Asian states of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, considered crucial to U.S. efforts on the ground in Afghanistan. He'll then travel on to Pakistan and India. Jeremy Scahill has more on the international developments surrounding the war in Afghanistan.
U.S. warplanes continue their carpet bombing in Afghanistan. Word out of the White House is that it will continue for the foreseeable future. Despite the increased calls from Muslim countries around the world for a halt to the bombing during Ramadan, President Bush said today there will be no let-up in the U.S. attacks.
My own personal attitude is that the enemy won't rest during Ramadan, and neither will we. We're going to pursue this war until we achieve our objective. As to the specific times and dates, and we'll let the military speak to that. They're in charge of this operation. This is not a political campaign. This is a war.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld is heading to Moscow today for talks with Russian officials on President Bush's war and also on administration attempts to abolish the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which the administration has called outdated. The Russian government says it opposes Bush's plans to build a so-called missile defense shield. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice made clear the Bush administration's militant stance.
The president has made clear that he believes that we're going to have to move beyond the ABM treaty for two reasons. First of all, because it constrains our ability to fully explore the possibilities for missile defense, and secondly, because he believes that it is not representative of the kind of relationship that we have with the Russians.
As the U.S. bombing continues, serious questions remain about the stability of the nuclear-powered Pakistani government. In recent days, the country's military ruler, General Pervez Musharraf, has been cracking down on opposition activists and religious leaders, rounding up clerics and putting others under house arrest. Protests continue in Pakistan against the government's cooperation with the Bush administration in attacking Afghanistan. Each new report of civilian deaths caused by American bombs fuels the fire of these protests. Musharraf's government has also arrested two top nuclear scientists. The government has refused to say exactly why they're being held. But all of these events have forced the Pakistani government on the defensive about the security of its nuclear weapons. Foreign Minister Abdul Sattar.
Any apprehension that the assets might fall into the hand of extremists is entirely imaginary, perhaps a product of distortions caused by TV images magnifying the sights and sounds of protesters.
In other news, the British Parliament has voted down a motion calling for a halt to the bombing during Ramadan. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
The anthrax threat has prompted Senators Edward Kennedy, a Massachusetts Democrat, and Bill Frist, a Tennessee Republican and physician, to push forward with legislation aimed at countering bioterrorism. The senators said their package would add more money to existing programs, such as stockpiling vaccines and antibiotics, and improving the capacity of local health workers to recognize and respond to a crisis. Critics are concerned, however, about other elements of the package, which would increase information sharing between police and intelligence agencies and pour resources into sophisticated surveillance and tracking technologies. They believe that steps taken in a time of crisis may lead to a long-standing erosion of civil liberties. Kata Mesta reports from Capitol Hill.
Congress is currently seeking an additional $20 billion over the $40 billion it already appropriated towards anti-terrorism efforts, saying various federal agencies have been shortchanged. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy said further action is needed to beef up Homeland Security.
We are strongly committed to making sure that the INS is going to get the latest and the best in terms of the monitoring kinds of equipment, and also that there is going to be the kind of cooperation, which is a key part of this legislation, between the various agencies.
Kennedy and a host of his colleagues are pushing legislation which would open the flow of intelligence between the CIA, FBI, the State Department, Office of Homeland Security, and the INS to screen potential immigrants and track international students within the United States. However, many students and teachers worry that such intelligence gathering will lead to racial profiling. The legislation restricts the issuance of visas to foreign nationals and students from countries that the State Department has determined are sponsors of terrorism. Julia Beattie, president of the United States Student Association, worries that the intelligence gathering on international students may be invasive and discriminatory.
We would obviously just be very concerned that it is the most pertinent information that is to be shared, you know, basic information in terms of, you know, where a person is going to study, you know, the length of time that they plan to stay, and, you know, information on, you know, their birthplace and things like that. We think that any other kind of information to be sharing about political affiliation, you know, is just unnecessary and, you know, obviously can lead to, you know, unfair, you know, targeting with certain students from certain countries. And that's what we want to avoid at all costs.
Civil rights advocates are further troubled that members of Congress are stepping up efforts to implement biometric technologies like palm prints, retina scans, and facial recognition at international points of entry and to track foreign students within the states. Anthony Romero, executive director of the ACLU in Washington, questions the reliability and constitutionality of biometric technology.
There are many concerns about the technologies. First, there's a concern about whether or not they will actually work. Some of the technologies around facial recognition, for instance, have a very high rate of false positives. They don't really recognize people as they span through public spaces. Secondly, of course, are the privacy considerations, so whether or not there will be infringements on our personal privacy and our personal lives in ways that are inappropriate. And thirdly, there's a question also about whether or not this is a useful use of our government resources. Government failed us on September 11th, and we spent many millions of taxpayer dollars on these programs. We should first ask ourselves, why did September 11th happen? And where are taxpayer dollars being put to use before we rush into allocating new dollars and new programs and new measures?
The House Appropriations Committee will begin considering a larger emergency spending package next week, causing critics to wonder which federal programs will be shortchanged in the process. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, I'm Kata Mester.
More than 150 members of New Yorkers Say No to War protested the detention of more than 1,000 people since the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The Department of Justice can hold the detainees for immigration violations, criminal charges, or as material witnesses. But the department has refused to release specific information about the individual detainees or the reasons for their detentions. Protesters demanded that the Justice Department make the information public or release the detainees. Mimi Rosenberg files this report from New York City.
Why are immigrants doing time, not accused of any crime? Why are immigrants doing time, not accused of any crime?
Approximately 150 demonstrators from New Yorkers Say No to War converged on the Immigration and Naturalization Service in Lower Manhattan to demand to know what has happened to the hundreds of people who have been detained as part of the Justice Department inquiry after September 11th. Who are those being held? How many are in custody? What charges are they being held on? And if there are no charges, why haven't they been released or cleared? Heidi Duro of New Yorkers Say No to War, an organizer of the protest, discusses its purpose.
What we're here to do today is draw attention to the issue of the hundreds of people who are being detained in relation to the September 11th investigation. The overwhelming majority of those people being detained are immigrants. What we want to highlight today is that the government has not given us a full disclosure about how many people are being held, where they're being held, who they are, what their charges are. We know very little information, and we're concerned that people's civil liberties are being violated. And we also want to say that as New Yorkers, we're concerned that people have full access to lawyers, attorneys in this process, that their rights are guaranteed, that they have full due process, and that we're concerned that immigrants may be subject to abuse during their incarceration, and we don't even know who's there or what their charges are, so we don't know what's happening to people.
Risha, a young South Asian woman, decried the deprivation of civil liberties for immigrants.
As a South Asian, I'm very appalled at immigrants being detained without any notification for up to a week, and I feel like the anti-terrorism bill is absolutely taking our civil liberties away from us. And the people who are being detained right now, there are women behind them, you know, there are women who are at home who might not feel like they can go out in public because their husbands or brothers or, you know, are already being scrutinized, and they're afraid. Muslim women are afraid to come out. So I think as feminist, I feel like I have a responsibility to be out here. As a South Asian and as someone who looks Arab, I feel like I should come out here and show my support to people who are being detained inside.
Risha amplifies her concern about immigrants' rights by describing an act of violence against someone she knows.
Actually, my really close friend got jumped right after the attacks, and he was beaten up fiercely. It happened the day after September 11th, and he was so afraid that he left the city. And just walking down the street, I noticed a lot more looks than I used to before the attacks.
Clark Kissinger from Refuse and Resist places the roundup of immigrants in a historic context.
One of the first things that happened after September 11th was a crackdown on political prisoners in jails across the country, ranging from Father Philip Berrigan to ex-Panthers like Sunday Adeokolu. They were put in administrative detention. They were put in lockdown, separated from other prisoners, not allowed to see their lawyers in some cases for 2 and 3 weeks. So that the attack on immigrants that's going on here is actually part of a much broader attack on civil liberties in this country. And, you know, they're basically saying to us, well, you have the right to ask questions, but you don't really have the right to question. And these roundups that we've had here, now over 1,000 people being held in detention without their names being released and so on, these are some of the biggest roundups we've had in this country since the Palmer raids in 1919 and 1920, or the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. And President Cheney has now come out and said, look, this is the new normalcy.
A further message of the demonstrators was, if you want to keep America safe, you need to modify U.S. foreign policy and not turn the U.S. into a gated community at the international level or a police state at the national one. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, your Building Bridges Reporters in Exile from WBAI Pacifica in New York.
1,000 immigrants locked away! This ain't justice, USA!
A plan hatched by Edison International and California state energy regulators to keep the utility out of bankruptcy has been suspended by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. A consumer group had asked the court to freeze the plan, which would have raised consumer rates to pay $3.3 billion in company debt. Aaron Glantz has more from Sacramento.
The California Public Utilities Commission agreed to the $3.3 billion consumer-financed bailout after the state legislature refused to give the giant utility a similar sum. After a federal judge approved the deal, a consumer group sued. The Utility Reform Network says the closed-door negotiations that resulted in the deal violated California's sunshine laws. And for now, the deal is void, sent back to the judge who approved the deal in the first place by a federal appeals court judge in San Francisco. Southern California Edison says it ran up billions of dollars in debts buying expensive power for its customers this summer and spring, but consumer advocates note the giant utility company also siphoned off more than $9 billion in lucrative assets to its corporate parent under the terms of California's electricity deregulation law, a law they note was written after hours in the utility's Sacramento office. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Clance.
This Sunday's presidential elections in Nicaragua will feature two faces familiar to voters. Enrique Bolaños, who until last year was vice president as part of the ruling Liberal Party government, and Daniel Ortega, who came to power with the Sandinista Revolution in 1979 and was the nation's president until 1990. U.S. media reports have focused on Bolaños' ties to corruption and Ortega's refashioning of the Sandinista Party. But as Robert Knight reports, economic policy may be the deciding factor for Nicaraguan voters.
Presidential elections are scheduled for Sunday in Nicaragua in what some see as a contest between the same old IMF policies and new improved Sandinista proposals. According to local polls, the race comes down to a choice between one-time President Daniel Ortega of the Sandinista Party and recent Vice President Enrique Bolaños of the ruling Liberal Party, whose incumbency has been marked by a growing economic gap between landowners and the majority poor, by corruption, and by high interest payments for multinational loans. Mark Cook is a veteran journalist who has spent years reporting in Central America and living in Nicaragua.
There's widespread starvation in a country that's a cornucopia of a country in terms of its potential agricultural production. There are people starving. But this is at the same time that massive amount of food is being exported from Nicaragua by Mr. Bolaños, among others, and much of this is being used to pay Nicaragua's foreign debt, which has been paid over and over again many times, but is, because of the outrageous loan and interest racket, is still owing. This is really remarkably like what happened in Ireland in 1847 during the Irish potato famine, when because of a potato blight, the Irish had nothing to eat, and yet during that whole time, huge amounts of food were being exported from Ireland to England because of the economic policies of the day. Well, the same policies are being applied right now, and that's where the opposition to Bolaños, the Liberal Party candidate in Nicaragua, is the strongest.
With foreign debt obligations, Bolaños is facing the same North American pressures that helped topple Daniel Ortega during the 1980s.
Nicaragua was suffering very, very badly under the economic conditions, but nowhere near what it's suffering today. People remember the Sandinista years as being actually considerably better off economically, as in fact they were, than they are today, except for very few people who have become very wealthy in the last few years with the Aliman liberal government. But for the vast majority of the population, the staggering levels of unemployment and of hunger are almost unbelievable. And this is not just in Nicaragua. This is across the board in every country in Latin America. Now, as far as Daniel Ortega's campaign goes, what he's proposing is to have a more just economic order, more fair. The poor see him as obviously giving them a better deal. The question is how far he can take that.
And that would be not very far if the uncounted voting district of Washington, D.C. has anything to do with it. U.S. Embassy personnel in Managua have repeatedly threatened diplomatic opposition and financial aid cutbacks if the Sandinistas return to power. And in Washington, both the Clinton and Bush administrations have withheld military aid from Nicaragua's armed forces until Sandinista elements were purged from leadership. Still, Cook says Ortega has an outside chance to beat Bolaños.
Daniel Ortega has some things going for him. He has a wider area of support. He has people who used to work for the U.S. Embassy. Agustin Harkin, for example, from the Social Christian Party, is his vice president. The other thing that he's got is essentially the prime minister during the Chamorro government of Violeta Chamorro, her son-in-law. So there's a technocratic element that is represented there that is supporting the Sandinistas because they regard them as a perhaps more viable economic option than the party of the extreme right. The question is how much will the Sandinistas be able to introduce any real economic reforms, or whether this will be just another round of what happened in the last 3 years of their last government when they had to introduce IMF-type economic reforms that really cut away at their own base, which was the urban working class of Managua and the other cities.
Journalist Mark Cook, who has spent years living in and reporting from Nicaragua, where the latest polls show a dead heat between Enrique Bolaños and Daniel Ortega in Sunday's presidential election. In New York, I'm Robert Knight. For Free Speech Radio News.
The future of the Pacifica Foundation may hinge on the outcome of talks being conducted today in San Francisco. Plaintiffs from four lawsuits against Pacifica, including listeners, members of local station advisory boards, and dissident national board members, are in mediation with members of the board majority and the foundation's lawyers. The network has been rent by conflict over mismanagement, censorship, and centralization of power for more than 2 years. But as Jeff Brady reports, recent weeks have brought precipitous changes at the nation's largest and oldest progressive radio network.
Pacifica Board Vice Chair Ken Ford has resigned this week, while Board Chair Robert Farrell and new Chair Marion Barry have been in closed meetings with litigants for the last 2 days. Leslie Kagan is one of the dissident board members that have brought suit against the Pacifica Foundation. She says disagreements between Pacifica's Chair Robert Farrell and Vice Chair Ken Ford may have brought about Ford's resignation. But she says comments made by Ford calling Pacifica activists zealots may have contributed pressure for him to resign.
The Al-Qaeda comments, you know, referring to people who are protesting and demonstrating, you know, people who are critical of the present, quote, leadership of the foundation, making an analogy between them and Al-Qaeda and terrorism is outrageous, of course. So he may have come under some pressure around that comment in particular.
Kagan says she doesn't know whether Ford has resigned because of pressure from other board members or he made his own decision to leave Pacifica. Kagan says while she's cautious about the changes, she says it was time for Ford to resign.
It's really, really hard to evaluate the meaning of this. Personally, I think that Ken Ford has been part of the problem for a long time, so I'm not at all sorry to see him stepping down. What the larger meaning of it is, we need probably a little more time, you know, a few more weeks to evaluate what the impact was.
This month's changes come weeks after Board Chair Farrell asked for the resignation of Executive Director Bessie Wash, who was criticized for mainstreaming Pacifica's progressive programming and spending an estimated $2 million on armed guards, high-priced lawyers, and public relations firms. Neither Board Chair Farrell nor Pacifica's public relations firm Williams & Connolly returned calls requesting comment for this story. Juan Gonzalez, one of the founders of the Pacifica campaign and former co-host of Democracy Now!, is hopeful that the Pacifica Foundation could be moving in a better direction.
There does seem to be a sense that given the fact that the only people that are negotiating are Farrell and Barry on the side of the Pacifica board, that means that the old people are not dictating what's going on. It's the new illegitimate board members that seem to be in charge. And that's hopeful because I would think that the old ones were so entrenched in not recognizing the validity of the Pacifica reform movement that at least this new group does see the need to have some kind of a rapprochement, some kind of a negotiated settlement.
Leslie Kagan spent a full day yesterday in those negotiations. She says she can't discuss the details of the meetings, but believes a settlement could be reached by tomorrow afternoon. Gonzalez says in this time of crisis, all public radio is important, as many people turn to the radio for news and information instead of entertainment, and it's important for Pacifica activists to clearly recognize the network's value.
We can't operate in a vacuum. There is a war going on. And I think many people on the left in America believe it is not a just war that is being perpetrated in Afghanistan. And if Pacifica is crippled in its ability to get that dissenting voices and information out to the public, it hurts the overall movement for justice and progress in American society. And so we have to take that into consideration. We can't act in a vacuum, and we can't let our emotions or our anger at what these people have done to the Pacifica Network hold us back from trying to figure out what is the best thing to do at this time in the battle to reform Pacifica.
Negotiations and litigation behind closed doors are expected to continue late tonight and into tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeff Brady in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown.